Good evening, the Perpetual Notion Machine for September 12th. I'm your mad scientist, Wally. With me is fellow mad scientist, Jason Neaton. He makes his way as a mild-mannered IT guy during the day, but he knows the secrets of a great Wisconsin passion. That's right, brewing beer. He was a lead microbiologist for Goose Island before they sold out and ran operations at one of the best breweries in the land, Three Floyds. Jason is an amazing beer nerd coming to us from New Glarus. He is here to talk about what makes beer better from a science perspective and give some tips to folks wanting to give it a try themselves. Welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine, Jason.
Thanks for having me, Wally. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, man. My pleasure. And I have tried the fruits of your fermentation before, and I can attest it is good. So can you tell us a little bit about what got you into the wild world of beer?
Sure. It's always an interesting circuitous route. We start drinking it first, and then, but as a scientist, you kind of fall in love with the science and process of it. I was doing research on heart transplantation and, you know, doing some serious medical research, and a friend bought me a homebrewing kit. Like many people get started that way. You know, I said, I can do this. I've got the skills and I understand what's going on here. So, I was living in Chicago at the time, so we just started doing home brews, keeping notes. I still have some of my original notebooks. You know, I go back and look at the recipes and the names I chose. It was a lot of fun. And yeah, it's a social thing. It takes a while. You know, people start kind of small, and then before you know it, you're building your own, you know, kind of semi-professional rig at home to try and do it like the big guys do. So
it's got the beer fridge going, keeping things frosty.
Oh, yeah.
So what does microbiology have to do with beer? And in the land of fancy new breweries, how are things changing over time?
Yeah, so obviously there's a lot of microbiology in beer because it's a fermentation science. You know, I always like to tell the history of beer, you know, which we don't have time for tonight all the way. But, you know, fermentation goes all the way back, you know, to the ancient Sumerians. But, you know, fermented beverages have been with us for a long time. And so I started looking at, you know, yeast. I had worked mostly with bacteria up at that point, although, you know, most of the time you're trying to keep bacteria out of beer. But nowadays it's really exploded into all kinds of funky stuff. The Belgians are a whole other, you know, kind of walk of that with using Pediococcus and Lactobacillus, and sours have become a big thing, right? So there's been a whole evolution. But I just started, you know, kind of getting into it. Started with, you know, dry yeast pack like most people do. Then you go into stuff like liquid yeast that you get from the shop, the smack packs where you pop them and then you let them kind of, you know, start up and ferment. And then after a while, you start maybe even doing your own starter yeast cultures. So it was kind of an evolution there. Getting a microscope, taking a look at what's going on underneath there. It's a lot of fun. But, you know, again, attention to detail, making sure that you get a beer fermented out, something you want to drink afterwards. You know, you can make some pretty bad batches. We didn't have too many of those, but we kind of caught the bug, as it were. And then, you know, it just kind of steamrolled from there. And then I got an opportunity to go and be professional, which was fun. So, yeah, at Goose Island. I was doing research and getting really frustrated with writing down no result. You know, I was doing, you know, heart transplant research. It was really important, but very tedious and very exacting. And I said, I like to tell the joke that when I brewed beer, I would 7 days later or 14 days later, I give it to people and they'd love it and, you know, thank me and smile. And it was a very social thing. So kind of, it became fun to become a maker, you know, essentially, and an artisan. And then at Goose Island, they were starting their production plant in 1996 on Fulton Street. They had a pub since 89, but they wanted to get their bottling going. You need a microbiologist. So they had a little room carved up in the top part of this old wood factory that was the brewery. It was not ideal. I had no fume hood. I said I probably took years off of my life doing analysis. I started Goose Island with another amazing brewer who runs a brewing empire out in California named Matt Brindleson, and he was a chemist and I was a microbiologist. So we brought that science to the process, and we wanted to analyze everything. He got his hands on an old spectrophotometer. He used to work at a company called Calsec doing hop extractions. Mm-hmm. So again, brought a lot of that science there, and we were trying to figure out, you know, how to make the very best Honker's ale there was, and we did, and we won many medals over the time. I was there from 96 to 2000, and yeah, it was quite an experience.
Heck yeah. I am in a conversation with my friend Jason Neaton, a beer mad scientist. He's mad about beer. He's mad about science. So we're talking about brewing beer. I like to go through the, if someone's, you know, thinking, oh my gosh, I can brew beer myself. That's amazing. Maybe it will be, even be good. What's the kind of a basic kit, or like how long would it take to get a homebrew kit together? Just some buckets, or, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Some people start with the buckets. Some people use glass carboys. I kind of prefer those. The buckets of the plastic can get scratched and you can get microbiological issues, but it's good to start with, you know, whatever's comfortable in your budget. You know, there's the Wine and Hop Shop in Madison's mm-hmm. a good place to go and outfit yourself with a lot of, you know, good material. But what happens when you're home brewing is you usually start with an extract, whether that's a powdered extract or in a can. Sometimes it's a syrup, and that's really just wort. You know, that's either dried down or put in a can that you can put into a certain amount of water. There's an instrument called the hydrometer that you use to measure the specific gravity, how much sugar you basically have gotten into that. Mm-hmm. The more sugar you have in, the more it ferments into alcohol. So you're stronger beers that are, you know, packed with sugar, and you need to pitch a lot more yeast to make sure they ferment out correctly.
Got you.
You know, so yeah, you get started with that. You get some hops. Hops usually are pelletized in little, like little rabbit pellets, mm-hmm. You know, but that helps to keep them fresh. You can get whole leaf as well. You know, I was just telling Wally that I grow hops at home, and I harvested a whole bunch of fresh hops that I'm going to be using for a home brew with a friend. My friend Mark and I are going to brew one of that soon. But yeah, it's really not too tough when you do it that way. Then people get you're boiling. You have to have some equipment. You're cooling it. You have to cool it down or find a way to cool it down. Sometimes people just literally go put their big pot in the snow if they're brewing in winter and use Mother Nature.
Hello, Wisconsin.
Or you get a little coil cooler. You run cold water through it and you immersion, you know, type of thing. I mean, you can trick it out a million different ways, but you can get started pretty easily. And then, you know, I would say this, if you really want to make it a lot easier, bottling is tough because you have to do priming sugar. Mm-hmm. You have to basically do a little secondary fermentation in the bottle. There's a little bit of calculation, and there's a lot of bottle cleaning, sanitation stuff. One of the greatest ways is when bars went from the old Cornelius keg system, which were these like metal cans that they did, you know, the soda in. They moved to bag and box. A lot of those became available. In fact, you happened to gift me a couple of those.
I did,
which
some bartanks,
I'm very happy for.
Thanks, Uncle Ted.
Yeah, I'd lost all my brewing equipment, so Wally helped restock me a bit. But those are easy because you just rack into them, and then if you get a little tank of CO2, you can force carbonate. But it's nice to have a place to chill it down too. So if you've got I used to have an old dorm fridge where I just basically bent the freezer back and made space, and I could like chill my beer in there too. So
cool.
So yeah, just get started. It's fun. It's fun to ferment.
You betcha. So, and it's a life. It's a living organism. You know, when you and that's why things that come up from across the sea in a green bottle, they get skunky. That's your Heineken and your Red Stripe, right? Because they got sunlight in there.
Light struck.
So can you walk us through the holy grail of Wisconsin beer, which is to say, now of course, as geeks, we can say, well, there's lots of other great stuff, but Spotted Cow, all right, our flagship of the state and of your and a great beer from your hometown, it doesn't travel that well. Is that why it doesn't make it outside of the state? So it's alive, right? I've heard you said it should be treated like milk, pretty much.
Well, yeah, I always say that treated like milk because beer is always best fresh. You know, I always look at freshest dates on cans, and you know, I'm glad when brewers do that because, you know, you don't want to drink something that's been sitting on the shelf for a long time. It's hard to keep beer fresh. New Glarus is not fresh in this date, and one of the reasons they don't is because they don't feel they need to. they control it. They don't let it go outside of the state. You know, they don't sell it outside, although people will bootleg it all the time, as we know. You know, bring me some Spotted Cow.
That's right.
I mean, Spotted Cow, it's an amazing flagship because it's a farmhouse ale. Nobody does farmhouse ales.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's very mellow and mild. I think that's why it's so popular. You know, a lot of beer enthusiasts, you know, will somewhat, you know, poo-poo it at times. But I think it's, you know, it's a really well-made beer. Like I said, Moon Man is, you know, one of the, I think, standards out there. Mm-hmm. You know, people just love it. It's got that nice kiss of the hop, a little bit of malt in there as well. But yeah, it, you know, again, keep your beer cold if you can. You know, don't store it in your warm garage. You know, treat it well. And again, look for those freshness dates on, you know, and other stuff.
But, sure.
You know, drink local.
That's right.
That's why pubs are fantastic, because, you know, they never have to put their beer in a bottle or a can. It's served right out of the vessel usually. So it should be very, very fresh. I went to a little pub over in Oregon the other day. Fantastic. Good food, you know, good beer. But again, I love drinking local.
Heck yeah. Okay. Last question. We got maybe a little more. Can you walk us through the tiny bubbles? So if we, you know, people think it's magic when they see that nitrogen, those teeny little bubbles versus the CO2 line. What's that doing to the beer when you've got different types of carriers like that?
Right. So this is probably a story that is best to start with the history. And I actually was at the Great Dane the other night having a pint of hand-pulled beer. In the old days, they didn't have CO2.
Oh, the engine, yeah.
Yeah, the beer engine. You know, again, that's a real living beer. You know, they would have to basically brew a beer, then they would rack it into a keg through the bunghole on the side where, you know, they have a wooden plug that would go in. Mm-hmm. But they had a secondary fermentation in that cask, just like they do when you homebrew and you do it in the bottle. It what happens is it pressurizes and it carbonates it to just the right level. So you got to calculate it right. It was very extensive. Publicans would have to put it up there on Thursday, get it positioned just right. Sometimes they would even add finings, which would actually help drop the yeast out so you didn't have a really chunky beer. You know, you'd have something that
was... What's a fining, like sawdust?
No, finings can be everything from carrageenan to actually isinglass, which is from the swim bladder of a sturgeon. So
I love the taste of it.
I know it's not the thing that you think you want to put into your beer, but it would drop that nicely down. They would have it in the rack, and then you would serve it until it'd be done on Sunday. But you're pushing oxygen in there. But the beer engine sprays it out, and really, when you oxygenate something before it opens it up. That's why people swirl wine in glasses. That's why you should drink your beer out of a glass so that you can get more of that aroma out of it. So what Guinness did in the nitrogen is to really emulate what a cask beer is without all the difficulty of making cask beer. I was telling Wally that when I was at Goose Island, Matt Brynaldson, our illustrious brewmaster, was like, we're going to do a nitro beer. Okay, do we know how to do this? No. Guinness doesn't tell anybody how to do that. That's very proprietary. So we figured it out. And, you know, we had to cap up all the tanks and take off all the safety valves because basically nitrogen hates to go into solution. CO2 goes easily in. And so you have to do it under these high pressures. And we were always worried that we were going to have some sort of explosion. But we made it.
It sounds safe, yeah. Yeah. Take safety valves off.
And we did do one of the first nitro IPAs.
Oh, cool.
Which, you know, again, with that hop and that creaminess, it's amazing how good that is. So that's really the difference between the CO2 and the nitrogen and why they did it.
You got to take your time, watch a cascade, right?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I love watching people pull a hand, pull beer because, again, that cascade time, you know. And, you know, Guinness even went so far as to do it in the can with a little widget.
Right.
So, you know, if after you're done with your Guinness can, that rattle around in there is like a little capsule of nitrogen that once it's open, you know.
Right, and kind of pour hard. If you ever see people drinking a Guinness can right to their face, savage.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all right, though. I'm not here to judge.
That's all right. You know, it's visual still, as well as you know, on your taste buds.
And I am sad to say that, as I knew it would, this went way too fast. We're going to do a beer series, though. So, you know, yeah. I've got enough mad scientist friends, but if I repeat about once a year, we'll talk more about beer, or maybe wine, or maybe hops, or who knows.
I'll tell you about my adventures in making cider.
Oh, yeah. Right, exactly.
Pressing fruit.
And, some wild fermentation out there. And yeah, Nuclearis, you're in great company with one of the best breweries in the land right in your backyard.
Indeed.
I'm always happy to go over and share a bonfire and some community, and that's what we're about here on this community radio station. So you've been listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I've been your mad scientist, Wally, in a conversation with my dear friend and mad scientist, Jason Neaton. This is the Collective Based Science News Show.